folks were concerned that certainly the public and possibly the political class would forget all about the reasons for the collapse of government planning, of centralized government planning, because politicians do have this obsession to gain power. And so they have incentives to ignore these things. That's why they adopt Keynesian economics, despite all the criticisms of it. And, you know, the academic economics profession abandoned Keynesian economics in the 70s when it could not explain stagflation. But that didn't really matter to many of the politicians because they understand that the general public is largely unaware of the criticisms of Keynesian economics. And so they keep spreading the same old line, the same old stories. And so these lessons in chapters 4 and 5 about planning are very important. You know, if we ever are to defeat the spectacle of socialist central planning, the road to serfdom, the road to tyranny, more and more the public has to understand these things. So I see from Wes that all are good, volume and audio, so I'll keep going. And so one of the first things that Hayek starts out talking about is what's known as the Marxian concentration doctrine. And what this said is basically is that capitalism, if left on its own, left unregulated, would evolve into first a series of monopolies and then possibly one big monopoly, one big company that that ran everything. And so our choice is to have private monopolies everywhere, or government-created and regulated monopolies that will be regulated in the public interest. And so surely the Marxists say you would prefer to have selfless, public-spirited government bureaucrats running these monopolies as opposed to greedy, profit-seeking capitalists. And that was the argument. That's one of the arguments that was very prevalent in Hayek's day. And he writes about it at the beginning of chapter 4. And so, but the fatal flaw in this argument is that it basically ignored both economic theory and economic reality or economic history because, and it confuses big business with monopoly. Now, at the time Hayek was writing, the early 20th century, the world had been through the second industrial revolution, and there had been the advent of large-scale manufacturing. But alongside the advent of large-scale manufacturing, big business, big corporations, was rapidly declining cost of production and rapidly declining prices. In the U.S., the whole late 19th century was a period of price inflation because of the vast expansion of production. And not only the expansion of production, but the invention of thousands of new products on the market. And so business per se was nothing to be feared in the eyes of all the economists at the time. In fact, one other article I would mention of mine, co-authored with Jack High a long time ago, 1988, is called Antitrust and Competition Historically Considered. It was in a journal called Economic Inquiry. And we showed that in the late 19th century, when the first anti-monopoly or antitrust laws were passed in the United States, the economics profession, such as it was at the time, was almost unanimously opposed to them because they thought that such laws would be inherently incompatible with competition. Because what they saw, yes, they saw mergers, corporate mergers, they saw consolidation, they saw big business, they saw mass production, but at the same time, they saw these things causing lower costs and lower prices to the tremendous benefit of the average consumer for decades at a time. Too, they saw this, and so that's what happens. Would be a big business is not to be feared on its own. After all, many big businesses have gone bankrupt. That's why the Fed has bailed so many of them out over the years. They've gone bankrupt, regardless of how big they are. That's the too big to fail doctrine, and of course I don't subscribe to that. And nobody should be too big to fail. And so that's it ignores the lesson that the effect of mass production was not in every single instance, but in most in this history was lower cost and lower prices, which is the opposite of monopoly. And government has always been a source of monopoly. And that's why I recommended on the chat before the class to take a look, if you're interested in pursuing this, take a look at my article called The Myth of Natural Monopoly. It was in the Review of Austrian Economics some years ago. I see from Cam, audio is breaking again. Well, I don't understand it. What the heck? I have a brand new computer and a brand new webcam. Well, let me know how it goes. I'll keep on going. I have no idea why it would be like that. Yeah, everything sounds is set correctly here, I think. Jack says Robert Murphy was breaking up yesterday. Oh boy. Let's see. Graham says he's missing 80% of what's being said. That's not good.
Hi, Tom. Can you hear me? Hi, Tom. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
So could you try turning off your video?
Okay. Well, right now, I don't see the icon on my screen for some reason.
Next to your name, there's a camera, a green camera icon.
Yeah, I know, but it disappeared somehow. Let me see. Oh, there it is. Okay.
Oh, here we go.
So now what?
So now could you start back from like maybe 5 minutes ago or so? Not, you don't have to go all the way back, but just maybe.
Okay, from just with just audio.
Yeah.
Okay. Hayek begins talking about how essentially the myth of natural monopoly, of how, and makes the point that governments have always been the creators of monopoly, contrary to the Marxian concentration doctrine that says it's a free market. And the next point he makes is a point that Hayek would make all throughout his life. And the main point is that the more complex, the more complicated an economy becomes, the more necessary it is to rely on markets, and the less feasible or the less thinkable it is that government planners could possibly plan an economy. We talked last week about the famous essay, I, Pencil, by Leonard Reed, that explains why, because of the tremendous amount of information and knowledge that's necessary to produce a simple thing like a pencil, no one human mind, or even no 100 human minds, could possibly possess it all. That if you think of something more complicated like an automobile, it's out of the question that it could be planned outside of the market system, which involves many thousands of people from all over the world who have unique knowledge of time and place. They have scientific knowledge also, and they collaborate to produce all the things in the economy. One of the articles that I put on my reading list is a short article by Thomas Sowell on amateurs versus professionals, where he makes the point that the reason socialism collapsed is that there were probably what's the number he gave? 24 million prices to be set on a daily basis by central planners in Russia. And that, of course, would be humanly impossible to even think about that. Okay, so now I have from Travis that I'm gold now, loud and clear. Video, now, I suppose. So, Danny, let me know if I can just proceed without video, and I'll leave the video icon off as far as that goes. Danny says, yes, does that mean leave the video off? Okay, I will do that then. Hayek also addresses the infant industry argument, where the socialists of his day like the ones of our day today, were making essentially the argument for patents. They were saying that, well, because of new technology, if businesses invent new technologies, they must be protected, that is, from competition, or else how can they profit from these new technologies? And because the new technologies will require a lot of investment, a lot of money, and without that protection from competition, this is not going to happen in efficient volume. And this is essentially the argument for patents, I guess, the government-imposed patent monopolies. So, but another way to look at this, though, is that once the government does grant a patent for some technology, then nobody else has any incentive to do any research and development in that area because it would be illegal to sell the products that you come up with in that area. So patents, I think you can make a straightforward economic argument, deter research and development for new technology because they send a message that it's futile or useless to do that because there's no profit in it. It's illegal to make profit in it. And so Hayek dismisses that argument as special pleading by would-be monopolists who want protection from competition. And another aspect of this is that it's competition itself that spurs the incentive to create new technologies. Because when you're in business, you have to compete. You have to come up with new products and new technologies or else you go out of business. And so if you protect people from competition, you destroy the very thing that spawns technological advance, the incentives created by competition. Okay, and of course he also discusses another issue of his day was there was a big push for government-imposed compulsory standards, standards in terms of how products operate, size, measurements, and so forth. And it wasn't enough, people were saying, that people would just adopt particular products in the free market, and then everyone would more or less adopt that product standard because that's what the consumers wanted. They were arguing for government-imposed compulsory standardization of products, and that would have the same effect that I just mentioned of destroying incentives for innovation if we did that. And this is similar to the whole area of economics called monopolistic competition in the 30s, which is, you know, the time Hayek was coming up with these ideas, you know, which he published in the early 40s. The theory of monopolistic competition came about, and it was created by two British authors, Joan Robinson and Edward Chamberlain, who both wrote books that were almost identical in the 1930s. And they said, well, yes, if you look at the economy, there are a lot of firms out there. In most industries, there are lots of competition. However, businesses try to differentiate their products either physically or through advertising. Advertising is a way, they said, to differentiate products, at least in the minds of consumers, if not physically out there. So therefore, yes, you might have this one aspect of competition, lots of companies competing, but every company's product is a monopoly because it's so unique. And so just like the words jumbo shrimp or military intelligence, monopolistic competition became popular. And so Hayek is taking that on. I don't think he actually uses the word monopolistic competition, but that's what he's talking about in his chapter 4 when he talks about compulsory standardization, because there were people calling for that. And this is not a dead idea. Any economics textbook that you pick up today will talk about this. And also, since I work at a university, I know there have been seminars in the past couple of years by law professors at my university bemoaning the fact that there's such tremendous product variety in so many industries, not just restaurants with, you know, big menus, but everywhere, and they're making a case for government regulation or laws and legislation to restrict the variety of products that are out there. They claim it's bad for consumers. And so they're trying to resurrect this old, discredited idea that businesses striving to please consumers by differentiating their products should be controlled or regulated. Now, of course, once you have a government institution that does that, that regulates that sort of thing, what you'll have is one big lobbying spree on the part of some companies to have the government prohibit the differentiated products of their competitors, but to allow theirs. And so that will lead to more monopoly, not less monopoly. But what can you expect from lawyers who obviously have never studied economics? That's the sort of thing. So it's not a dead issue. And in the late 70s and early 80s, actually, there was a famous federal antitrust case in the U.S. Economists refer to it as the cereals case because the government sued General Foods, General Mills, and Kellogg's for creating a supposedly shared monopoly. They claimed that they had 70% of the dry cereal market, and they achieved that through experimenting with different types of cereal. And many of these different brands of cereal caught on, people liked them, and these three companies were rewarded with a very big market share, 70% among just three companies. The companies eventually won the lawsuit when the judge in the case made a remark that I could paraphrase, saying, well, I don't like dry cereal. I eat bacon and eggs in the morning. And he was making the point that there are a lot of substitutes for dry cereal. So even if they did corner the market, which they did not, there are a lot of substitutes. You could eat bagels. You could eat other things, oatmeal. And so they did not have any ability to charge monopoly prices. But still, these companies spent many millions of dollars and for years and years diverted management talent away from producing better and cheaper products to an antitrust battle in the government. And that probably was the purpose all along of the competitors of these three companies who were probably the instigators of a government lawsuit against them. And another, I'm always amazed at how prescient Hayek was at some of the issues that eventually came up in the age of the internet and after the computer revolution. And one of them is the issue of the technical superiority of a product versus consumer sovereignty. Hayek talks about this in Chapter 4 of The Road to Serfdom. And I've run across this plenty of times. And I taught MBA classes for years. And I always had some software engineers in the class. And one thing they all had in common is they hated Microsoft and Microsoft products, which their companies competed with. And they would tell me about these products where Microsoft, maybe say a financial software product, and Microsoft had a 70 or 80% market share. And then they would explain to me the best they could why their product was so superior. Well, Hayek makes the point, which is a point an economist would make, is that doesn't matter. The technological superior of your product doesn't matter if the consumers don't understand it, that it's superior, or if it's not superior enough to give the consumer an incentive to switch. You know, if your product is 1% superior than my product, well, people might not think it's worth the time and effort to learn the new technology and switch. You know, for what, 1% savings of time? You know, why should I do that? And so what really matters in a market economy is the consumer idea of what the best product is, not just technical superiority. And of course, there have been a lot of flim-flam artists who have made these arguments also. And there's a great book on this that is written by two economists they don't call themselves Austrian economists, but I consider their research to be very compatible with Austrian economics. It's Stan Liebowitz and Steve Margolis, and their book is Winners, Losers, and Microsoft, published maybe 10 or 12 years ago. And one of the things they talk about is how QWERTY, you know, the keyboard, the computer keyboard that says QWERTY, Q-W-E-R-T-Y on the upper left of the keyboard, how did that become the configuration of the keys on a typewriter and then later on a computer keyboard? There's a theory in economics associated with a man named Paul David the consumers were allowed to choose this, and they chose an inferior technology because there was a different technology during the day of typewriters that was called the Dvorak system, and it's spelled D, and then V is in Victor, O-R-A-K, Dvorak. But it turns out that Mr. Dvorak, whose name is attached to this alternative keyboard, was an officer in the United States Navy who invented this keyboard, and he had his own secretaries test the keyboard by typing with it compared to the QWERTY keyboard, and guess what? He concluded that his keyboard, which he had a patent on, was superior. And so Leibowitz and Margolis discovered this, and it led them to be highly suspicious of the claims that there is an inferior technology that was walked in, so to speak. And so they actually got people to do experiments, typists, professional typists, to type on both types of keyboards, and concluded that there really wasn't much of a difference. And for whatever reasons, the consumers chose the QWERTY keyboard, so QWERTY is king. And so there are a lot of stories like this where people have claimed that my technology is superior, but it doesn't matter. And what matters is what the consumer chooses, and that's the point Hayek makes here. With regard to planners, one point Hayek makes is that they always seem to have a great exaggeration of the importance of the ends that they place foremost. That is, government planners, if you're somebody who's really, really bothered by cigarette smoke, then you might devote a tremendous amount of your time to organizing the banning of smoking outside as well as inside, even on the sidewalk, because that's your thing. If you're bothered by perfume, you might become an anti-perfume activist and work to have it banned in your town, or at least restricted and regulated in public, and have people kicked out of restaurants because you have allergies that are incited by the perfume. Whatever your thing is, I just use those two things off the top of my head. That's the point Hayek is making, is that they seem to have no perspective about other things such as freedom and toleration. They think that the thing that is of interest to them should be of utmost importance. One example of this that I wrote about years ago is I lived in a town that was the city fathers, so to speak, were wanting to ban all sorts of advertising signs. They thought there were too many signs on the sides of the highways. It was ugly. And that, everyone can relate to that. Everyone would rather look at a placid lake compared to a lake surrounded by all kinds of signs for gas stations and hotels. And so I wrote a few articles at the time in the local paper pointing out that there's a trade-off here, like in all aspects of life. And the trade-off is that advertising is an important part of competition. And if you ban advertising, you'll have less competition. And with less competition, you usually get higher prices and shoddier products and services. And so I wasn't being dogmatic about, signs everywhere. I was just trying to make people aware of the fact that there are trade-offs here to think about. But the sign people, this was their thing. They wanted to eradicate signs, and they got very upset and angry over this. And these are the kinds of people Hayek is talking about, where they have their one thing that they exaggerate the importance of that one thing in the overall society. And he says this, such people tend to be, quote, the most intolerant of the plans of others. So the local business person who opens up his or her business and wants to advertise and get customers, well, that's their plan. Your plan is to ban advertising. Well, that's a different plan, and the two will clash. And Hayek makes the point that planners tend to be intolerant of those other people and other people's plans. I assume the volume is still okay because I don't see any chat over here. Chapter 5 on planning and democracy, Hayek reiterates the fact that the language of the common good, the public interest makes little sense. And here he's talking about something that my old professor, James Buchanan, coined a phrase for. He coined the phrase political externalities to explain how in a democracy we have all or none voting. If it's a presidential election or a congressional election, you don't get to have your president. You have to have, as president, whoever wins the majority of the election. You don't get to have your member of Congress. You have to put up with whoever won the majority of votes in the election for Congress. Unlike the marketplace, if I want to be a Coca-Cola drinker and you want to be a Sprite drinker, you can drink your Sprite and I can have my Coke. And so in the marketplace, goods are always partitionable like that. But in politics, we have all or none decision making. And what that means is that basically, at the very best, what people get is what the middle of the road voter wants. Because the middle of the road voters, that's most of the people. So at the very best in a democracy, you get what you might call the median voter, or the middle of the road person, what their preferences might be satisfied. But then people who want government to be drastically smaller are worse off, because government is not drastically small. And then there are also people who want government to be drastically bigger and more activist. They don't get what they want either. And so these people who are dissatisfied and happy at the results of the majority rule election, they suffer from what Buchanan called political externalities. And that's just the reality of democracy. And so this language of the common good, the public good, it always implies unanimity, doesn't it? And of course, nothing is ever unanimous in politics. And if it was, you wouldn't need government to do it. If it was unanimous, and if people agreed unanimously, they would voluntarily do it. You wouldn't need the coercion of government to force it on them, to force them to pay taxes for it. They would buy it. And that's what the free market is all about. When you go to the store and buy a carton of milk, there's unanimity there. You want the milk, they want your money, you both agree unanimously that the trade would be a good idea. Their milk for your money. That's the market, but politics is not like that. Hayek here also, he makes a different point than Buchanan's point on the futility of this, the language of the common good, which, by the way, was the slogan of fascism, the common good before self-interest. Was the slogan of the Nazis and the Italian fascists in the 1920s and 30s. But Hayek makes a different point. And he says, even if we had a benevolent dictator, a benevolent and omniscient dictator, no dictator could possibly perceive all of the millions of individualized preferences in the minds of the citizens. You know, in order to serve the common good, that means everyone, that means unanimity. The benevolent dictator would have to know what the preferences are of every last individual and serve them. And that, of course, is unthinkable, and it's impossible, and it could never happen. And so that's a slightly different point about the futility of this language of the common good or the public interest than the one James Buchanan made. Where there can be some common agreement, Hayek says, is for means but not ends. That is, we can choose to have democracy versus dictatorship, but it's impossible to talk about the ends of democracy, you know, the actual legislation that comes about, or the actual people that are going to be elected and so forth. But we can have at least, you know, unanimity or near unanimity on the means, he says. And another aspect of this too that is important is that the smaller a society, the more likely this will be true. The smaller the society. Of course, a society like the United States with 330 million people, it's ridiculous to think of agreement on anything, unanimous agreement on anything, means or ends. It's only in the relatively small societies like the Swiss cantons that this sort of thing, that democracy, even makes any sense at all. That was the view of the American founders, and I think that's still true today. And that's something that Hayek touches upon also when he discusses federalism. He also mocks the idea that government institutions can be taken out of politics, like the idea of the independent Fed, for example, which is a farcical notion because the chairman of the Fed is appointed by the president. It's a political institution. It may serve private interests, as all political institutions do in some way, but it is also controlled for the most part by politicians who choose the chairman of the Fed and other members of the Fed. And so, business like government is an oxymoron because Yet governments sometimes try to make their enterprises look like businesses. They might appoint a board of directors. They might call the person in charge the chief executive officer. But no private business has its capital and its payroll paid for by somebody else, namely the taxpayers. A real private business has to borrow money, go in debt, or use retained earnings to keep itself going, or all three, or all those things. Whereas government enterprises rely on coercive taxation. And so no government enterprise could ever be like a business because of that point alone that is out there. Okay. And Hayek goes on here to talk about how socialism, he talks a great deal about how socialism or government planning is inherently incompatible with democracy. That's why he's making these comments. And the essence of this is he said that government planned economy always requires some sort of unitary plan. And he makes the argument that this is inherently incompatible with democracy. Because if the government is going to impose a unitary plan on everyone, you can't really have a Bill of Rights and allow free speech. Free speech might overturn the plan. It might convince people to overthrow the government itself, let alone its plan. You can't have the powers, you can't have checks and balances, because the checks and balances might stifle the ability of the government to implement the plan. That's called gridlock in contemporary parlance. And you certainly could not allow federalism. You could not allow the people, the citizens of the states and localities to have much sway in their economic life, because that would violate the unitary economic plan idea. So you can't really have Bill of Rights, three branches of government, or federalism. And these are the aspects of the American version of democracy anyway. And you couldn't really have that under government planning, and certainly under socialism, Hayek says. And one of the famous points about remarks, it's a small remark in The Road to Serfdom, is that Hayek makes the point that government planning is simply imposing the personal preferences of the planners by force on the public and replacing the plans of government bureaucrats, for the plans of individuals. It's not that we individuals do not plan. I plan what I'm going to say tonight in the class. You plan your job, your education. You plan the raising of your family, everything. We all plan all day long, every day. We make plans. And so it's not as though we do not have a planned economy. The issue is who is to do the planning. And of course, government planning inevitably fails. Price controls create shortages and all sorts of other issues. And then what always happens is when one government plan fails, politicians are never inclined to admit that they've failed. And so they will keep trying. They will have another plan, and it will fail, and a third plan, and it will fail. And so this inevitably leads to calls for what Hayek called an economic dictator. Someone wants somebody to take charge and just order everybody around and make things work that way. And this is the ultimate misunderstanding of the spontaneous order of markets. And this is why I mentioned in the chat before the class that if you're interested in this particular point, go to Wikipedia and type in list of U.S. executive branch czars. I'm holding it in my hand right here. And there's a table that shows that in the U.S. from the years 1933 until the year 2001, on average, American presidents appointed four czars, being part of an MG czar, for example. And what is a CZAR? And what a czar is a presidential appointee who usually does not have to go through Senate approval, so the normal constitutional process is blocked. And that person is given extraordinary powers to influence different aspects of society and different industries, like a dictator. These are the economic dictators that Hayek is talking about. And like I said, from 1933 to 2001, on average, presidents had four czars. But then George W. Bush had 33, and Barack Obama has 38. And so in the last two American presidents, they increased the number of czars almost tenfold. And if you look at the list of czars, I'll read some of them off of this list from Wikipedia. Foreign aid czar, AIDS czar, anti-poverty czar, Asian carp czar. So there's a fish who has its own czar. Automobile czar, bank bailout czar, bioethics czar, bird flu czar, birth control czar, cleanup czar, budget czar, consumer czar, cyber security czar, copyright czar, domestic policy czar, domestic violence czar, on and on, drug czar. Of course, there's a lot of drug czars. Ethics czar, that's pretty funny. Faith-based czar. So if you're a religious person, you'll be comforted to know that there's a government czar overseeing your religious faith. And it just goes on and on and on. So this is exactly the type of thing Hayek is warning about in The Road to Serfdom, that when government's plans fail, governments never give up. They never give up unless they're absolutely forced into it, such as with the collapse of the Soviet Union. But they have all these czars, dictators, strongmen like Mussolini. So we have all the, we have at least 40 Mussolinis running around Washington, D.C. Today. Okay, and so and Hayek does make the point that I made also. He says that democracy only works when government planning is restricted to areas of more or less common agreement. And here's where he's praising the U.S. Constitution, and he's arguing that, well, if you read Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution, it lists, I think, 18 things that are the legitimate constitutional functions of the U.S. government. Of course, the U.S. government now thinks it has closer to 18 million things that it does, not 18 things, and so that was long ago abandoned. But he makes the point that it only makes sense to have a democracy only when the domain of government planning and government tinkering is very, very limited to those things that you could get, if not unanimous agreement, a large amount of common agreement to, such as these things, the Article 1, Section 8. And he does recognize, of course, at the end of this Chapter 5, that democracy can be arbitrary, just like dictatorship. We have executive orders, for example. We have czars. And, democracy can create socialized medicine, which it is about to do in the United States. And that will involve many thousands of arbitrary rules by government bureaucrats imposed on the public. And so democracy, he was not deluding himself. You know, he praises democracy over dictatorship at some points, and he certainly doesn't approve of dictatorship, but he's not a wide-eyed idealist about democracy either. The third chapter for tonight on planning versus the rule of law. What is the rule of law? The ancient idea of the rule of law is that the laws in a society should be, one, clearly stated and easily understood by the public, and two, they should apply to everyone, even the rulers. No one should be above the law. That, in a nutshell, is the rule of law. And so, and Hayek wrote about the rule of law. He wrote entire books about the rule of law elsewhere. And The Road to Serfdom is probably the first place where he ever wrote in a lot of detail his thoughts about the rule of law. And so there are fixed rules, not arbitrary rules. They're fixed and they're understandable rules, and they apply to everyone. That's the ideal, anyway, of the rule of law. And Hayek makes the case that government planning is inherently incompatible with the rule of law, because planning, by definition, is a big mishmash of ad hoc rules and dictates that can change on the whim of any bureaucrat. And so they're not fixed rules, and they don't apply to everybody. They create redistributions of income, rules regarding how various industries are to be operated or controlled by the government create winners and losers everywhere. And so government planning always creates winners and losers. If the government decides that we need to establish a monopoly in the electric power industry, as it did over 100 years ago in most cities in the U.S., well, then the losers end up being customers who end up paying monopoly prices, government-regulated monopoly prices, and the winners are the people who run the electric power companies who make monopoly profits. And that's just one simple example. And so by definition, Hayek argues that planning creates an endless array of redistribution of income and wealth in society, which is exactly the opposite of the idea of rule of law. And he makes a great analogy here. He says the idea of the rule of law is sort of similar to putting up road signs telling you where to go. But government planning orders you where to go. It doesn't say if you turn left, you'll end up in Chicago, and if you turn right, you'll end up in Pittsburgh. It says you are hereby ordered to go to Chicago or we will put you in prison. It tells you where to go. It just doesn't put up the road signs. So it's the rules of the road versus ordering everyone where to go is the metaphor that Hayek uses to explain how planning is incompatible with the rule of law. And the final point he makes is, and this is a good example of that, all these sort of simple but profound statements that are in the Road to Serfdom, where Hayek says, the more the state plans, the more difficult it is for individuals to plan. Well, that is certainly true. Once the state starts planning your life for you by running the schools, educating your children, and so forth, a lot of people just give up and say, why should I spend a minute of my time or a dollar of my money planning on this if the government is going to take over this function? And so, this point that Hayek makes reminds me of another book written by Charles Murray. It's called In Pursuit, and then there's a colon there. The subtitle is Of Happiness and Good Government. And one of the themes of this book, In Pursuit by Charles Murray, is how government has crowded out so many functions of the civil society. Social Security led a lot of people to quit planning for their own retirement or to do less of it, and to quit or do less planning to take care of their own parents and grandparents in their old age because the government will do it. Public schooling tells people, don't worry about educating your children, the government will do it. The welfare state tells people, don't worry about the people in your neighborhood or who belong to your church who are in need. We'll take care of it. We, the government, will take care of it. And so people withdraw from doing these things for their fellow man because the government monopolizes everything, monopolizes these things. Police, and the American frontier, in the civil society, communities police themselves. They hired their own private police. They had their own constitutions and so forth. But then governments came along and took everything over. And so the people decide, well, we shouldn't lift a finger for our own security. The government is taking care of our own security. And so and that's the attitude a lot of people have today when they think if somebody breaks into their home, all they need to do is call 911. But if you believe that, you should really read a book entitled Dial 911 and Die. And so that's the point, the last point that Hayek makes. One of the last points is that the more the state plans, the more difficult it is for individuals to plan. And I would say not only does it make it more difficult, but it reduces or eliminates the incentive to plan your own life if you think somebody else is going to do it for you and for your children or your neighbors and your community. And that's the theme of Charles Murray's book. And this is not the only book that has this theme, but it's a memorable one. It's published, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago. And so I think that's about all I planned on saying for tonight for these three chapters. And I don't know what happened, why we can't have the video, why we have an audio problem. Someone said that Bob Murphy had the same problem last night. But I'm sure our geniuses at the Mises Institute will figure it out. Danny Sanchez is great, and so is Cam. So if you have questions, I'll keep looking at the chat, and I'll do my best to answer whatever questions you have. Let's see, Wes is asking, when Hayek uses the term democracy, is he thinking of the U.S. representative republic? Yes, I think he is. He certainly is not talking about unlimited democracy. He's talking about the American system of limited constitutional government when he mentions democracy in the Road to Serfdom. The British, of course, have an unwritten constitution. It's handed down through common law over hundreds of years, but it is a constitution. It's called a constitution. And so he was referring to that system, the parliamentary system, or the American system. Let me know if you have any more questions. I'll sit around and look at the chat. Okay, Wes, repeat my comment about Keynesianism in the 70s. Yes, the academic economic establishment abandoned Keynesian economics in the 1970s because it could not explain stagflation, which was the simultaneous increase in inflation and unemployment. And that's one of the reasons, by the way, that Hayek was awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics in 1974, because his book, Prices in Production, which was published around 1919, did have an explanation of stagflation. And so Keynesianism was debunked. That's why the Keynesian economists reinvented themselves. They started calling themselves post-Keynesians in the 1980s, because even they recognized that you don't want to be called a Keynesian anymore than you would want to be called a communist back then. But politicians never gave up on it, because Keynesianism, in the eyes of the uneducated masses, always provided a plausible rationale for wild, unlimited, and irresponsible government spending. And that's what keeps them in their jobs. And so it's been resurrected a bit by people like Paul Krugman, whose agenda, obviously, is to shrink the private sector down to as small as humanly possible by confiscating as much tax money from the pockets of the producing class and giving it to the non-producing class. He's a socialist, after all, Paul Krugman. And so socialists, of course, do not want to abandon Keynesianism, but the big majority of the economics profession did. Even Franco Modigliani, who was an old Keynesian, he's long since dead, but I can remember somewhere around the late 70s, he gave his presidential address to the American Economic Association. And it's published in the American Economic Review. It might have been 1979 or 1980, around there, maybe even earlier. And it was sort of an admission that Keynesianism had been a failure. And he was saying, well, we need to reinvent it. We need to try harder. He didn't just say, I give up. But even the most prominent Nobel Prize winning Keynesians pretty much said, we were wrong. We failed. So, and if you're not an academic like me, you wouldn't know these things. Yes, that was after Nixon said we're all Keynesians now. He said that, I think, in, 1971, something like that. But that was just before stagflation. Stagflation became a reality in 74, 75, 76, and to the end of the decade. Any more questions? Let's see. No, I guess not. Well, I guess we can call it a night then, I guess. I'm sorry about the video. There's one more from Wes. Wes wants to know how the term liberal came to mean something different in the U.S. They're not just different, Wes, but the opposite. The socialists of the world understood that liberalism was very popular. People like freedom. And so they simply started calling themselves liberals. And through repetition, it caught on. And I think that's how it happened, through repetition. Very dishonest. And so thanks for suffering through the audio. Well, hopefully next week we'll have the video version of this also, I'm sure Danny would be working his fingernails to the bone on this. And have a good night.